you with the report of the committee on the report of the general counsel.
Mr. Moderator, fathers and brethren, last night I became what former moderator Gance Little says is the person who is next to being a living moderator. I expected to report to you this morning on minor details, significant and important, but still minor details of the actions of General Counsel. But I now find myself reporting in a preliminary way to you about a very serious issue. I was on this platform before you 21 or 2 hours ago conducting a communion service in which we declared our unity in Jesus Christ, a unity that binds us together in spite of differences and tensions and triumphs over it because we are in Christ. Two weeks ago, today, in New York, some of the members of General Counsel were together talking about what we would do as representatives of the United Presbyterian Church if the presentations of the Black Manifesto should be brought to our church. We were aware that they would be brought and would probably be brought to the General Board of the National Council on the next day. And we decided as we met together that our response would not be one of obstructing conversations and dialogue. We would seek to listen, but that our response then would be within the regular, responsible avenues of church structure by which decisions are arrived at. In the General Board meeting of the National Council the next day, this kind of procedure was followed. Mr. James Foreman, representing the Black Economic Development Group, spoke with restraint and within a time limit, and he was heard. And the matter was referred to heads of communions, a special committee representing all denominations, which will consider the requests that were made and will give an answer sometime the end of June. The General Counsel of this church met on Monday here in San Antonio. I have never seen a General Counsel in the more than 10 years that I've been related to it as a corresponding member deal so exhaustively, so seriously with a single problem. What should we do in anticipation? Or certainly, Mr. Foreman knew that the assembly was meeting in San Antonio. Should we try to arrange a way that had been successful before the General Board, or should we wait and perhaps have a disruption in which we would not be able to talk to one another? And by yesterday, about noon, we decided. By that time, we knew also that he had made an approach through the office of the Board of National Missions. And so we invited him. What I'm saying to you is that the consideration of an invitation had begun several days before. We still believe that the process of listening without compromising our position is a Christian one. Secondly, Every agency and committee of the General Assembly is an agency of the General Assembly. And while the General Assembly is in session for one of its major agencies to deal with an issue that has national significance without any reference to the General Assembly is irresponsible. We do not expect that you will be able or want to or should respond by an action. But at least you should know something of what the issues are and should give your tacit approval to the continuing process through the committees of this assembly and the agencies of the church by which answers to these problems may be arrived at. Needless to say, we are here for the first day. One could have hoped we had gotten better acquainted with one another before issues of this kind would come up. But we're here to listen to one another, even to listen to people who disagree with us, and to listen then to God and to act. We had expected that Mr. Foreman would speak to us for 20 minutes. There would be some other presentations under the Church's Committee on Church and Race, with Dr. Hawkins concluding the presentation. But this morning it became evident that there were two presentations that were clamoring to be made to this assembly and actually needed to be made, one from the Brown Group as well as the Black Group. And therefore, we now present to you a spokesman for the Brown Group first, Mr. Foreman having kindly stepped down and allowed the Brown Group to speak first. And I represent the Reverend Antonio Medina, one of our own pastors in the Los Angeles area, who will introduce the speaker for the Brown Group. He has 20 minutes.
Thank you, Dr. Smith, Mr. Moderator, brothers and sisters. God is at work in the world. We know that He is at work because this is a time of tension and a time of conflict and a time of crises. We also know that He is at work because it is also a time of redemption and a time of reconciliation. Reconciliation and redemption through the work of God through His Holy Spirit. God, in His infinite freedom, chooses to speak to us, not perhaps through the vehicles that we may define, but through instruments that He Himself chooses. You have noticed, no doubt, in the display area, a sign that reads the motto for our display area of La Raza that says that the Spirit speaks for La Raza, or the Spirit speaks through La Raza. It is in keeping in line with this that I take now the privilege of introducing to you Mr. Eliezer Risco, who is the editor of La Raza, a barrio communications paper in Los Angeles. He is also professor of ethnic studies at Fresno State University. He is a member of the IFCO board, and in his spare time is a national consultant to the Spanish-speaking ministries, not only of the Presbyterian Church, but also for the other Protestant denominations. And I present to you at this time Eliezer Risco.
I speak to you not as a leader, I speak to you not as spokesman, I speak to you as a mouthpiece. I'm speaking here only because the Brown Caucus, or the Caucus of La Raza, decided that all of us couldn't speak, so one would have to do it. But what I'm going to say was written down by the group as a whole upon days and days of deliberation. We have been working on these demands for quite a while. People throughout the Third World, Latin America, Africa, and Asia, speak about the church in connection with the whole phenomena of what Western civilization has done to the Third World. And people speak about what I call the three M's: missionaries, money, and Marines. The church, by omission sometimes, sometimes by silence, but many times by active collaboration, has inflicted to people throughout the Third World some of the same ills that colonization has brought to the Third World. And that doesn't apply only to people who are Third World people in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, but also to people who are members of that Third World here in the U.S. I think that I remember reading somewhere in the history of the Reformation that one of the goals, one of the spiritual goals as well as institutional goals of the Reformation was for the community of believers to have self-determination as against the Roman Curia. I seem to remember reading somewhere also that the World Council of Churches, since their meeting in Madras, has been talking about the need for self-determination of people that up to now, to then and up to now, were being considered only as subjects for missions. And I think that if the church is going to survive the crisis that the world and the church is facing with today, the church has to make good that promise of self-determination. And I repeat, if the church is going to survive the crisis, the church has to make good that promise of self-determination. Because people throughout the world are involved in a revolutionary struggle for self-determination and liberation. And the church has to do what Elder Cleaver sometimes says: you have to decide whether you are going to be part of the problem or part of the solution. And more than that, I think that even for the church spiritually, not just institutionally, if the conscience of Christianity, if the moral credibility of Christianity is to remain, and it has been quite damaged up to now, the church has to deal within itself with the question of self-determination, justice, and more than that, with the pressing question of liberation. Throughout Latin America and within the U.S., there is a movement that we call the movement of La Raza. Mexicans, Cubans, and Bolivians, and Colombians, and Argentinians, and Chileans are involved. Here in the U.S., predominantly Chicanos in the Southwest, and Puerto Ricans in the Northeast and in the island of Puerto Rico are engaged in that very same struggle for self-determination and liberation. The display that you see in the display area referred to before that says, "Por mi raza habla el espíritu," is a conviction that is within the Latin American people that we are arriving at a historic moment in which the possibility for fulfilling the potential that is historically in us to be fulfilled, and that we ourselves will have to carry through to fulfillment that promise of greatness and potential of human spirit that is within La Raza. And that is the point from which we are addressing you today. Point one, community control of health, education, and welfare programs and agencies in the U.S. and Latin countries to those communities. This also means community ownerships of such facilities and buildings as neighborhood and settlement houses, schools, hospitals, and the turning over of real estate holdings for the occupation and ownership of low-income families where the church has holding in today's slum areas. In order to guarantee the operation or continued operation of those facilities and services, a budget based on needs as determined by the community should be guaranteed for as long as the community deems necessary. The process of facing those health, education, and welfare programs and agencies should be begun as soon as possible, but no later than the fall of 1969. Point two, Spanish-speaking churches will no longer be considered as missions. Boards, agencies, and judicatories of the church will be mandated to facilitate with Spanish-speaking churches the development of a style of life and ministry that is reflective of our culture and spiritual reality. This not only applies to U.S. Spanish-speaking churches, but to those in Latin America also. The implementation of this autochthonous rule for Latin American churches will be entrusted to Spanish-speaking churches within the U.S. Point three, a proportion equal to the national percentage of Spanish-speaking population nationally or local percentage, whichever is higher, of all program funds for ministries, services, church and community development will be earmarked for the use of Spanish-speaking communities. Point four, these programs and the goals of the movement of La Raza cannot be implemented without financial resources. Therefore, we request from the United Presbyterian Church seed money as follows. A, seed money for phasing in community control of these programs mentioned above as soon as possible. B, seed money for assistance in the building of the now going on movement of La Raza through conferences, workshops, training institutes, and so forth. An approximate figure for this seed money would be in the area of $250,000 to $500,000. Point five. The church will liquidate and transfer to cooperative associations of poor people in Latin America all investments and holdings in private corporations in Latin America. Furthermore, the church should disassociate itself from any programs of the U.S. government and private corporations that Latin American liberation forces denounce as exploitative and neocolonialist. Six, furthermore, we support any and all demands of our brothers in the Third World as made within the Black Manifesto. Point seven, once this assembly has approved and set in motion mechanisms for implementation of these demands, the General Council should be supportive of our request through JSAC, National Council of Churches, and any other church agencies of other Protestant denominations so they can respond likewise. One specific example that I want to bring to you today comes from Chicago, where as of last night, people from the surrounding Latin American community in Chicago of Lincoln Park have occupied McCormick Seminary. But somebody from that community should explain to you much better what is happening right there. And it's only as an illustration of the what it means in those communities to talk about self-determination and liberation. Obad Lopez.
Last night, the poor community of Lincoln Park, under the leadership of the Young Lords Organization, the Latin American community, a political action group, took under its control the McCormick Theological Seminary of Chicago, or rather the administration building of the theological, McCormick Theological Seminary. The purpose of this action was to confront the church with its own inconsistency and with its own inadequacy. The poor community of Lincoln Park presented 10 demands to the board of directors of the McCormick Theological Seminary and gave a reasonable time for an answer. And the answer that the community received was not considered satisfactory. The demands that were presented to them are the following. Number one, that McCormick Seminary immediately turn over to the community $601,000 for low-cost housing development. Number two, that McCormick Seminary provide a building and recreational facilities for a badly needed cooperative daycare center. That the seminary provide a bus so that children can be picked up for the center. Number three, that all the apartments owned by McCormick Seminary and rented to people in the community should be rented to poor and working class families. Number four, that the fence around McCormick Seminary be turned down so that the seminary can become a part of the community, not a fortress against the community. Number five, we demand that the stone building be made available to the Puerto Rican community for the creation of a Puerto Rican cultural center to preserve and strengthen our cultural and historical heritage, and to transmit these values to other peoples in our community and in Chicago. If it is found mutually advantageous to the McCormick Seminary and to the Young Lords Organization, we propose that the seminary make available to the Young Lords Organization sufficient funds to purchase the property of Armitage Dayton Methodist Church to be made the Puerto Rican Cultural Center. Number six, that McCormick Seminary extend a grant in the amount of $25,000 to the Young Lords Organization to be used in a community leadership development program and in the continuation and strengthening of the work of protecting and serving our poor community. Number seven, we demand that McCormick Seminary actively support the efforts of the Latin American Defense Organization to end the arbitrariness of the Cook County Department of Public Aid in its dealings with welfare recipients and with welfare recipients' defense groups. Specifically, it is demanded that McCormick publicly support the three demands at LADO, the Latin American Defense Organization, along with the Wicker Park Coalition for Welfare Rights, have submitted to David Daniel, director of the Cook County Department of Public Aid, and to George Dunn, president of the Cook County Board of Commissioners. The demands are: one, the removal of Walter A. Cunningham, District Office Supervisor, and James Patterson, Assistant Office Supervisor, for their lack of sensitivity to the needs and the human dignity of welfare recipients at the Wicker Park Public Aid Office. Voice of the community served by the Wicker Park Office in the selection of a new director of the office. Voice in the interpretation and implementation of welfare laws and regulations at the Wicker Park Office level. We demand that this support be expressed in letters to David Daniel, director of Cook County Department of Public Aid, and to George Dunn, president of the Cook County Board of Commissioners. Number eight, we demand that McCormick Seminary extend a grant in the amount of $25,000 to the Latin American Defense Organization to further our aims of creating a strong organization for welfare recipients in our community. Number nine, we demand that McCormick Seminary publicly oppose and condemn the political persecution carried out by the city of Chicago against poor people's organizations such as the Black Panther Party, the Latin American Defense Organization, and the Young Lords Organization. McCormick Seminary must demand from the respective authorities that charges arising out of political arrests be dropped by the complaining institutions, namely Department of Urban Renewal, Cook County Department of Public Aid, Chicago Police Department, the City of Chicago, and the State's Attorney's Office. The Young Lords Organization and the Wicker Park Welfare Office defendants, and in particular, Jose Chacha Jimenez, chairman of the Young Lords Organization, and Obed Lopez, must not be jailed and punished for their beliefs in justice and for their concern for their community's rights. Number 10, we demand that McCormick Seminary extend a seed money grant in the amount of $25,000 to establish a legal bureau controlled by poor people's organizations, the attorneys to be chosen by the organization, to work full-time for them, and to be responsible only to them.
Moderator, I wish that you would now recognize Dr. Gabe Wilmore, who is the secretary, the executive director of the Council on Church and Race.
Good. Dr. Wilmore.
Mr. Moderator, fathers and brethren, I have been in direct contact with the La Raza caucus here in San Antonio, and the caucus representing the National Black Economic Development Conference with respect to the procedures to be followed during this hour. I think you ought to know that you have masked on the platform representatives of both the black and the brown community who are members and clergy of our United Presbyterian Church and who are members of the San Antonio community, both brown and black citizens. And they are here to demonstrate visibly their support in principle, in spirit, of the challenge that is being presented to our General Assembly by these two groups in concert and in coordination with one another. It was agreed that the two principals of the two groups would be Brother Risco for the Spanish-speaking caucus and Brother Foreman for the Black caucus. You've already heard from Brother Lopez as a, shall we say, supplementary presentation in connection with Risco's presentation. And you will hear Brother J. Metz Rollins, the Executive Director of the National Committee of Black Churchmen, as a supplementary supporting presentation of the black church community. Then we suggested that this hour be wound up by your hearing from one who is well known to every commissioner here, I'm sure, and certainly respected and honored throughout our church, Dr. Edler Hawkins, who is the chairman, along with Mr. Neal of New York, of the Council on Church and Race of our denomination. After that, I think we must begin to think what kind of response this church is to make to what many of us, and I personally feel, are legitimate, justifiable demands from a beleaguered people. I first met Mr. Foreman when our church was bearing witness to freedom in Mississippi in 1964, when John Smith, former moderator himself, walked the picket line at Hattiesburg, Mississippi. James Foreman at that time was executive director of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. I got to know Jim at that time, and so did John Smith, as a courageous man, a man of integrity, a man with a passion for freedom burning in his breast. He is today the chairman of the International Affairs Division of SNCC, but more importantly for us, he is the representative of the National Black Economic Development Conference, which has accelerated the black revolution in this country within the last 3 weeks. And he comes here to speak in behalf of that new movement, which has taken the place of the civil rights movement in this country, which represents the militant black poor in this country and every other black person who is concerned about freedom and justice in American society. In a sermon that I preached in Germantown Community Church last Sunday, I called Jim Foreman a prophet for our time. And I still call him that. Scriptures tell us that if a man has aught against us, we ought to go to him and find out what it is and be reconciled to him and then go to worship. That's why we have interrupted the regular order of business, because this man says he has something against the Christian church. Some of your own black brethren and some of your brown brethren say amen. Let us hear him speak now. James Foreman.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, members of the police department, the press, and what have you. I'm happy to be here. As you know, I come to you as chairman of the United Black Appeal, which is a division of the National Black Economic Development Conference. I'm extremely appreciative of the conference for allowing the brothers from the Spanish-speaking community, La Raza, to appear before you and to allow me to appear before you. I think that this is a very significant occasion for oppressed people in the United States have united to present before the white Christian church, which we maintain is racist, a position that we think that the church can help to eliminate itself from the racism. Brother from La Raza spoke to you about the three M's, the money, the missionaries, and the Marines. It is an objective fact that when black people came to the United States in 1619, long before the descendants of many of the Europeans came to this country, we came not as Christians, we came as pagans, as the Christians called us. And the justification for our coming to this country was rationalized by saying that it is better for us to be slaves in the United States, working 16 to 17 to 18 hours a day without any pay. It is better for us to be slaves inside the United States where we have a chance to become Christians than to remain in Africa, our continent, our motherland, where we're dwelling in peace. This rationalization continued to extend throughout the period of slavery, and that cannot be denied. And the fact that our demands against the Christian church today is based upon several principles. Number one, that the Christian church is not just a building in and of itself. It represents its membership. And the membership of the white racist Christian church was predominantly white, which began to exploit the resources of black people in this country. This is a fact which the church cannot deny. Many of the black brethren have pointed out that the church itself owned slaves in many instances. And certainly the slave owners would go to church on a Sunday morning and pray to God, but would whip our mothers and fathers with lashes on the backs the next day. The same is true after Reconstruction. During the period of Reconstruction, after the Emancipation Proclamation, many of the Christians who had been defeated in the Civil War began to re-enslave us through a process of sharecropping. And that by the turn of the 20th century, black people were not involved in the industrial process of this country, that the resources and the riches of the country had been gathered by the white races who had been exploiting us, who had enslaved us in the name of Christianity for the most part. This is an objective fact that we cannot deny. And the church itself, which is involved in very heavy financial responsibilities throughout the world, has accumulated the resources and the richness of the church through that process of exploitation, through that process of slave income, if you will. The church today has tremendous amount of investments, so much investments that the church cannot be considered a religious institution. The church today, and this is a point that we try to make, and we're trying to let everybody understand this, black, brown, green, or white, that the church in the United States today is a financial institution. Members sitting in this room do not even know where the funds from the United Presbyterian Foundation is in fact invested. Many sitting in this room do not understand that the Presbyterian Foundation is investing in South Africa, in corporations which invest in South Africa, which further exploit black people as well as Rhodesia. Many people in this room today do not question what, in fact, the Presbyterian Foundation does with the money that it has continually accumulated over years after years after years. We in this room do not question the real estate holdings, for instance, of the Catholic Church, which is the largest corporation inside the United States, larger than General Motors, and certainly around the world, and is responsible primarily for the exploitation of our brothers and sisters from La Raza. The same is true of the Episcopalian Church, Trinity Episcopalian Church in New York City alone has assets of over $350 million, which it continuously invests in. It's a small church on Wall Street. And where did it get this money from? Who were the rock-bottom Christians who came to this country and began to enslave black people? Were they pagans? Or were they Episcopalians, Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Methodists, Baptists? These are the premises upon which we make our demands upon the white racist Christian church today. And to make it more contemporary, let us look at Riverside Church, which projected me, unfortunately, into a national situation, but we will have to deal with that. Let's look at the Board of Trustees of Riverside Church in New York, not the Board of Deacons, which traditionally is the power in a Baptist church, but the Board of Trustees at Riverside Church comprises Winthrop W. Aldrich, 30 Rockefeller Plaza, who's related to the Rockefeller family. Victor C. Brink, president, the Graduate School of Business at Columbia, which owns the land that Rockefeller Plaza is located on. James A. Farmer, Sr. of American Telephone and Telegraph. John H. Fisher, he's from Teachers College, Small Fry. Robert G. Fuller, president of the board of Erie Lackawanna Railroad Company. William H. Green of the American Can Company. Francis S. Armand, a former Mississippi Attorney General. Charles Glenn King, Director of the Research Grants Administration of St. Luke's. Ward B. Ogden, the Treasurer of the Board of Price Waterhouse and Company. Charles C. Tillinghast, Jr., who's President of Transworld Airlines. Donald H. Elliott, who's Secretary of the Board of the City Planning Commission in New York, directly related to Mayor Lindsay. And it is the Board of Trustees which controls the tremendous wealth of Riverside Church. Now, Reverend Campbell of Riverside Church has admitted, in his own words, that the moral thrust which we injected into the church has forced him and the Board of Deacons to grant that they have to pay reparations, which is a form of penitence, to the black community, to the disadvantaged. Of course, they're not willing to give that to the National Black Economic Development Conference, and that's another fight. But nevertheless, he has admitted the justification and the correctness of what the position we have put before him. What we're saying, gentlemen, and we're saying this about the Presbyterian Church today, that it is not just a religious institution. It is not just a religious institution and has not been just a religious institution since its inception on the shores of the United States. For if it were a religious institution, then Presbyterians would not have been slave owners. Presbyterians would not be investing in South Africa if we took the teachings of Jesus to our hearts. And we say that we are on sound theological grounds when we go to any Christian church and say that you're moneylenders, hustlers, for we are following the footsteps of Jesus, but we don't make that comparison. That is for the Christian brothers to make for us. What we're saying, though, is that we make certain demands of the white racist Christian church and the Jewish synagogue today. We're asking for $500 million in reparations, which is to be spent in the following way. Now, we've escalated the demands because of new knowledge that we found out about the church, and I'll explain that in a minute. But nevertheless, our original program called for a $200 million to establish a national land bank in the Deep South where we would have cooperative farms, where we know our people are sharecroppers, tenant farmers, and day laborers, and have no economic base whatsoever in the South. But with the $200 million land bank, we could establish tremendous amounts of cooperative farms. Second point, of course, was four major printing industries. Now, no Presbyterian can deny the value of a printing establishment as long as Presbyterian life is being printed by the Presbyterian Church. We're saying in the black community, we need to have four major printing establishments funded with no less than $10 million each, which comes to the sum of $40 million, to be located in Detroit, Los Angeles, Atlanta, and New York. Our third demand was for establishment of television networks in four major cities of this country, which would be the most scientific futuristic television apparatus that we can locate. These to be funded by $10 million each. We have some copies of the manifesto which we will pass out after the service. The next point, thank you. The next point was the establishment of a research skills center to be funded by no less than $30 million each. The next point was, of course, a training center in filmmaking, radio making, television making, to be funded with no less than $10 million. We all know that the television industry in this country is racist, that its cameramen look around us, exclude black people by and large, and if you go to the TV stations, you will see that NBC, CBS, and ABC have all tied up, are all tied up with basically white technicians. And we want a training center where this can be eliminated, and we then know that our next move will be to bust the racist white unions. We also call for $10 million to assist in the organization of welfare mothers. We call for a $20 million national labor strike and defense fund. Black people in this country are extremely dissatisfied, and many of them are unorganized. In the major plants of this country, we see black workers 60 and 70% of the population. And yet, we say that the United Automobile Workers is a racist union, for if it were not, then it would be supporting the demands of some of the churchmen that all United States investment come out of South Africa. But instead, we find that General Motors, Ford, Chrysler are all investing in South Africa, and the unions in this country are not doing anything about this particular situation. And we know that black workers understand the condition of our people in Africa, and they have to understand that more and more. But in order to organize black workers, we must have a labor strike and defense fund. Next thing, of course, we call for is United Black Appeal to be funded with $20 million each. This United Black Appeal is to generate capital, raise money throughout the United States, not only for the program of the National Black Economic Development Conference, but also to establish cooperatives in Africa. We recognize that we have to be self-reliant insofar as that is possible within the black community, given the structure of government under which we live, and it is necessary to launch a massive United Black Appeal, which we have started to do. And with the money from the United Black Appeal, we intend to establish a Black Anti-Defamation League to protect our African image inside the United States. Then we call, lastly, for $130 million for the establishment of a black university. To us, this means more than just a black board of trustees, teachers, and faculties. This means, in fact, that we will eliminate some of the class bias that operates in American education today. The reality of black life is that many people cannot get into college because they've dropped out of school at 17, 18 years old in the 10th grade or the 6th grade or what have you. And we want a university where anybody of any age can feel that there's a community to which he can come in order to learn, because many of our people will reach the age of 35 or 45 because they had to go to segregated schools, want to learn, but there's no place available which for them to come. And our egos are important, because many people who cannot read and write will not tell you they cannot read and write because of the whole emphasis and value prestige upon reading and writing in this society, and it works a psychological handicap. That basically is how we intend to spend the $500 million which we're asking in reparations. Now, we have been going to different churches and different synagogues, not any synagogues as of yet, but we've also been making certain demands. Now, as you know, there was an ad hoc committee for justice from the Presbyterian Church which made certain demands upon the Presbyterian Church. We had intended to come to this church in a different manner, but certain events made us come to it in the manner in which we did. And therefore, we would like to say, to read out the special demands that we are making of the Presbyterian Church. The first demand that the ad hoc committee made, I'm authorized to tell you, has been dropped. And that demand was that Kenneth G. Nye be replaced as the General Secretary of the Board of National Missions. We have dropped that demand because we have come to find out that there was a certain amount of bureaucracy involved in this particular letter, which went out, which shows you how bureaucratic the church structure is, but we nevertheless are reasonable people and are willing to drop this particular demand. So that's out of the window. Although we certainly think that Brother Nye has to look at that administrative apparatus which he has up there and not to allow these kinds of mistakes to occur again. The second demand is just a general demand, and that is that the General Assembly of the Presbyterian Church helped implement the Black Manifesto. Now, concretely, demand number three has been enlarged from that the Mexican Americans be given all land held by the Presbyterian Church into New Mexico to a total support of the demands which have been made here this afternoon by the representative of La Raza. Number four, that the Presbyterian Church turn over all its land holdings in all southern states, specifically the states of Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, and Mississippi, to the National Black Economic Development Conference to be used for the benefit of poor black people through its program. What we're saying is this, gentlemen, is that, and sisters, that the church does not need all of the land that it has. Much of the Presbyterian land is idle in the state of Mississippi, for instance. And this is something that you do not realize as commissioners, as members of the Presbyterian Church. And we're saying that an investigation of this land would reveal that much of it is idle and that much of it could be used in the development of cooperative farms inside the United States and would give an opportunity to have economic development for black people. Thank you. Second point was that $80 million be channeled through IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation, the community organization, by the Presbyterian Church for the National Black Economic Development Conference for the implementation of the Black Manifesto. Now, somebody will say, well, the church doesn't have $80 million, which it has in fluid funds. But the church has a membership which represents some of the richest people in this country. In fact, some of them operate the CIA, incidentally. And, you know, S.H.A. Ham, who's a Presbyterian, he works with the Central Intelligence Agency. And if you check the other Presbyterians, you will find that they're very, very involved in the power structure and the business enterprise of this country. Now, that's also our contention, that the church is not just an edifice. The church is not just made of righteous men such as you who are sitting in this room, but the church is also made up of people, you know, who call themselves Christians, who contribute to the church, and the church has a moral responsibility to exact tithes from these people for the economic development of the black community because they're all involved in exploitative machinery. Englehart is a classic example. I'm not sure he's a Presbyterian. But nevertheless, he's all involved in the economic operations of Africa and throughout the world. And that the church has a right to go and call upon its memberships who are rich, white, racist businessmen to put some money back into the black community and the Spanish-speaking community of this country. Next point, that the Presbyterian Church liquidate all its assets in South Africa, which is a demand that is almost non-negotiable, and channel those assets through IFCO to the National Black Economic Development Conference. And that a black person acceptable to the United Black Presbyterians be put in charge of the African desk and that the program be enlarged. This is a very serious problem, gentlemen, because one of the things that we make inside our manifesto is that, in fact, the only guarantee that black people have against, the guarantee they have against racism is to have revolutionary black people concerned about the total humanity of this world in charge, really in charge of total control of the country, but to exercise humane leadership, and that whites who are prepared to deal with their racism must be prepared to accept black leadership. Now, it's ironic that in the Presbyterian Church, the man who's in charge of the African program is a white man when there's so many qualified black Presbyterians who could run that program. That's a very, very real problem that the question the church ought to grapple with, certainly at this particular meeting. Next point is that the Presbyterian Church make available, and this is for the benefit of everybody in the Presbyterian Church, incidentally, a complete listing of all church holdings and stocks, bonds, real estate investment, unrelated business interests, pension, retirement, investment funds, and that 60% of the income from all these investments be annually given to the National Black Economic Development Conference. The purpose of that is that, you know, the church tries to maintain a rationale, give up that goods to the poor and go and do some stewardship. We say that if that is true, then the church, which is a financial empire unto itself, must make certain sacrifices. And if the church has accumulated the wealth through the whole exploitative machinery, and that is true, gentlemen, we cannot doubt that. I've seen the directory of the Presbyterian Foundation. I know where that money is invested in stocks and so forth. And I also know that those companies are exploiting black people around the world as well as other people of color. And that the church does not need all of those assets in order to function as a church. The church does not need all those assets to function as a church. And there's an interlocking relationship today between the church, business, and government. They're all in cahoots. Now, many of the people who are out here who are normal Christians, good Christians, trying to be good Christians, do not in fact understand what James Pugh is doing with the United Presbyterian Foundation. This is a serious problem. And if it can't be resolved at the General Assembly, then where can it be resolved? This is the point that we're raising. Where can it be resolved? People will tell you that the Presbyterian Foundation is a separate entity. The Episcopalians tried to tell us that the pension fund was a separate entity from Bishop Hines, who's the Episcopal bishop in charge of the church, that he has nothing to do with the pension fund. Well, where is the pension fund invested? The same thing is true that we tried to raise with the membership of Riverside, which is why all of that notoriety. We were saying to the membership of Riverside that if you can't control the board of directors, or rather the board of trustees, then who can? By what right does a few people have to perpetually sit up on money and to continually invest this in God knows what? Because we know that the Riverside Church in New York is heavily involved in real estate investment inside the United States, inside New York in particular. When Rockefeller Plaza can be completely tax exempt, then something is wrong. So what we're saying, we're not really raising the question that the church should be paying taxes to the United States because we don't feel it should, but it should be paying taxes to the National Black Economic Development Conference for the... But this is a real problem. And so we're saying that if we take serious the question of our stewardship of our ministry, then we must begin to divest the church of its financial involvement in business and government. No one is saying that the church should not operate. No one is saying that some people have to be cut back from their salaries or that some people don't need three secretaries and what have you, although they could do with one. Nevertheless, we're saying that the church has to seriously consider whether or not it is a financial entity inside the United States at this particular moment. This is the question that we're trying to get across. And we know many commissioners, many average church people who give dollars and dimes to the church do not understand how involved the church is in the government and how the government uses the church for its legitimate interests. How the CIA is involved in the use of the church in overseas domination. And we say this is relevant for black people today because we're concerned about the total humanity of the world. We're concerned about our brothers and sisters in Africa, about our Spanish-speaking brothers in Latin America and inside this country. And we come to you today pleading, if you don't do anything else, to understand, and we still have some liberated territory up there at 475, which is being expanded to the 9th and the 12th floor. But nevertheless, if you don't do anything else, then certainly begin to understand how, in fact, the church is a financial empire inside the United States, and that was not the original intention of the church, and the church can begin to make restitutions. Reparations is, in fact, a part of penitence, and we thank you for this time, and we'll be available to discuss with you anywhere else, and we again say we must, in fact, begin to make reparations. We must begin to have economic development in the black community. And reparations is legitimate. And the white Christian church, which has been a part of our exploitation, must begin to pay those reparations. And we hope that this General Assembly will act as men and women and not let somebody tell you, let's refer this to some sort of board which is going to be bureaucratic and stifle demands. Where is your power? As a General Assembly, if in fact you are concerned, if in fact you're interested in eliminating racism, then we should not leave here until there are some answers to the demands made by Spanish-speaking and black people of this country. Thank you.
There are several reasons, at least I think, why I'm here
as a part of this program. Because in addition to being a black Presbyterian clergyman, I'm also the executive director for the National Committee of Black Churchmen. And perhaps in this statement, which wasn't too widely circulated, those of you who will have to wrestle with the demands of the manifesto may get some clue from black churchmen who have taken seriously this demand, and who through the years, in the context of the predominantly white church institution, have struggled mightily to be taken seriously. And in part, this is why we're here, and why the spirit of many black churchmen, including black Presbyterians, is right in the heart of what Jim Foreman is saying. Now, the National Committee of Black Churchmen is made up of everybody from black Roman Catholic priests to Church of God people, black denominations primarily. We have what we call real soul ecumenicity. It has nothing to do with creed or dogma. It is a common recognition of the black experience, regardless of the religious hang-up that we're a part of. And this is important to understand. And so it was the board of directors that met a week ago yesterday that considered the Black Manifesto, and we considered it after we had heard Brother Foreman. And we gave this following response, and we call upon this church and the other churches to look at the spirit of this response as they debate with the confrontation that's been put upon them. We rise to salute the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, which sponsored the National Black Economic Development Conference, which in turn became the channel through which James Foreman could appear as a modern-day prophet to speak to the churches. We are mindful that the program proposed has troubled the waters of Siloam. You dig it, baby, it's biblical. Yet we know that however much the churches may shake to the vibrations of its own cleansing, the healing of Christ is working upon them. In other words, we're trying to say that this is not something from the outside. But this is very much a part of God's ongoing activity in the history of the world and in the history of the church. We have taken action to support in principle the demands of the National Black Economic Development Conference upon the churches and synagogues of the United States as a beginning. And I want to say to you that it's important to realize that there were some brothers last week in Atlanta who thought Jim Foreman was too conservative, and that there were some who said that the manifesto was essentially a reformist paper position. So I just keep in mind that those of us who were part of the National Committee of Black Churchmen, we emphasize as a beginning. And the next thing is a fairly historical statement, which Jim has already alluded to. And in the interest of time, I will move on to the gut issues of our statement. It must be clearly understood that the black church does not stand in the same dock as the white church before the bar of justice. And that includes the black church within the predominantly white church. Black churches were victims rather than the guardians and perpetuators of racism in America. Yet this is a thing that has not been picked up, and I emphasize it again, we do nevertheless accept the responsibility of the black churches to share in the remuneration of the black communities, for we recognize that it is these communities which have sustained our churches over the years. And even our black brothers who have been a part of the United Presbyterian Churches all these years, we are beginning to discover and understand where our life and our heart and soul is. And it is with black folks. No matter our commitment, our belief in order and procedure, our commitment is with the black revolution. We urge the black caucuses in the predominantly white churches and the black denominations to play a major role in interpreting the justness, humaneness, and the theological soundness of the demands of the black manifesto. This is important. Therefore, we urge all the religious black caucuses and our brethren within the predominantly black denominations to accept the responsibility to develop the strategies necessary to obtain the funds which are demanded. We further call upon them to assess the institutional assets of their respective denominations and to negotiate the specific amounts which are to be allocated through IFCO for the purposes outlined in the manifesto. We have become wise in the ways of those who act, my sisters and brothers, and there is an effort to isolate Jim Forman, make him look like a kook. There's an effort to discredit IFCO. There's an effort to discredit any of those who have responded positively to the Black Manifesto. And this is why it was so important what the Board of Directors of the National Committee did in Atlanta last week. The pursuance of these ends, we appeal to the Black caucuses and the Black denominations to unify their efforts of advocacy and implementation of the Manifesto through the coordination provided by the National Committee of Black Churchmen. We instruct the Executive Director of NCBC to immediately begin this activity. And this explains my presence with Jim Forman, the Catholic Archdiocese, on last Friday in New York, and on Monday in the presence of Bishop Hines. And I want to say again that those representatives of Cardinal Cook on Friday, Bishop Hines, they did take us seriously. They did take the whole idea of the manifesto seriously. In that sense, they were acting, quote, as responsible churchmen. The other, Philip, that we added to the statement in support was that we insist that the great foundations not be excluded from this vanguard contributors from the private sector. Many of the foundations are creatures of corporations whose founders and stockholders amassed incredibly huge fortunes from a capitalistic system which was rooted and grounded in the exploitation of our forefathers. While a few of them have supported the civil rights movement, none of them have done what they ought to have done about the mountain crisis among non-white peoples in the urban and rural ghettos of the nation. We call upon the foundations as well as the churches and synagogues to provide millions of dollars for economic and social development in the Black community. The NCBC, through its executive director and its affiliates, is ready to participate in whatever conferences and negotiations may ensure from the demands of our brothers for the reparational relief of the suffering of Black people. We urge the private sector, the American economy, particularly the churches, synagogues, and foundations, to receive these demands with utmost seriousness. Now, one of the things that's probably going in your minds, and then I'm through, is that, you know, in each place that we've gone, each time Jim has been, the church always trots out its record of involvement. But we never really were radically changing anything. We were never radically changing our modus operandi, our style of mission. And in our response to the civil rights movement in the past, much of what we did, while it was helpful, was also no more than protection and buffer. It kept the rank and file of our membership from really knowing what it was about. On Sunday, I was up in northern Westchester, one of our nice, predominantly white congregations. And I didn't realize how uptight they were after I made my presentation in behalf of this. And in the word coming back and forward, almost a sort of physical sense. Because for the first time, in spite of all that our Presbyterian church has been doing over the last 10 to 15 years, the manifesto, the Black manifesto, had finally gotten under their skins. And they were upset. And this is what it's all about. Radical challenge has been placed before us. And it's too late to talk about moderation and propriety and understanding, and gradualism, and give us a little time. The means are available. The will to use them must not be withheld. Peace and power.
I suspect that perhaps the only person in this auditorium that has a more difficult job than myself is a moderator. And I would hope that we might find the occasion for movement today. What we have had a demonstration of is not so much the fact that there's anything new in the deep, critical nature of our time in relation to the black and the brown community. All that we have had is a very sharp indication of the new sense of drama with which this condition has been lifted up very dramatically before us. And it seems to me that no great length of words should be the part of any of us. We are the part of the problem. We're involved in the complicity and the compilation of evil in our time. And yet there's some of us who have some very real problems. Because somewhere along the line, there were those of us who stood in a church such as ours and made a commitment to the Lord Jesus Christ. A commitment that was born out of the idea that this was a Christ, our own words, who did proclaim release to the captives and all the rest that we know so well. There's been the desire on the part of some to live by that. And there's been a desire on the part of many of us who are part of the black community and also who are part of a church such as ours, the hope that we could live in these two worlds. This has been our faith, and we've tried to live by this. There's a sense in which, to some degree, we have felt a responsibility to our white brothers as we have lived within this common fellowship. And we want to remain within it. We have been trying to say, as part of that responsibility, that not perhaps the deepest, but certainly one of the deepest levels of frustration and disillusionment on the part of the black community and the brown community came at the point of the Kerner Report. That did not say anything new, but that lifted up dramatically this sense of the two societies into which we were drifting. The response to which was so terribly disappointing. And we come to this moment that many of us hope will represent both a challenge and the necessity to respond. I recall some other words that come back. It came at another point in the struggle for civil rights. And we remember those words. Late, we have come. But there was a sense in which, at that point, and for that level, we came. The basis of our faith requires a response. Some of us who were on the platform here were at a very distinct disadvantage because we were not able to hear the terms of these demands. That's not important. It seems to me that our will, our determination to move as fast and as full as a church such as ours can move, becomes our immediate responsibility at this point. And if I happen to be a commissioner of this General Assembly, I would like very much to make the kind of motion that within the framework of how this General Assembly can operate, a motion that would enable us to move seriously and as completely as we can in the direction of a response to what we have heard this day from our brown and our black brothers. And because we do stand within this kind of faith that requires the response, the hope is that somehow under God, we may be able to give it.
Mr. moderator. This completes the presentation from the General Counsel's report. I am led to say that if we had a Cardinal Cook, that's where we would have recommended that James Forman and our Brown brethren also should go. We don't have a cardinal. If we had a presiding Bishop Hines, as the Episcopal Church has, we would have recommended they go there. We don't have a presiding bishop. But we'd have a General Assembly. And so this is where we recommended that these things should be heard. And now we have a procedure in the General Assembly. Sometimes it's a very bureaucratic procedure, but when we pay attention and use it, it can get things done. There's an article in the manual, page 136 and 32, that says that all resolutions for the appropriation of money, and these resolutions were at least that, shall be submitted to the General Council for consideration and recommendation before action is taken by the General Assembly. I believe that this is the channel. I have talked to the Secretary of the General Council, and we are prepared to call a meeting immediately following the closing of the session this evening in the St. Anthony Hotel, where we've been accustomed to meet. Edler Hawkins is a member of the council. Gay Wilmore is on the staff. Brian George and others are there to advise us. Roger Granados, and I would say Reverend Antonio Medina, would also be invited on this occasion so that we will have the full reading of those presentations. Some of us behind the microphone are not able to hear nearly as clearly as you can hear. And may we make Gay and one of you responsible for, and perhaps if you would like to bring someone else with you, it would be satisfactory. That will be our initial look at them. There should be some immediate places where some of these go. Some of them are long-term and will take far longer than this meeting of the General Assembly. But some of them can be given attention. And we shall try our best to report to you about what we do with all of them as soon as possible.